Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts. Each week at this time, the H.J. Heinz Company, makers of the famous 57 varieties, gives you information, please. A quartet of experts is on hand to answer your questions. Send them to Information, Please, at 570 Lexington Avenue, New York City. We may edit them a bit, and in case of similarity, you'll have to accept our judgment of who shall be paid. If we use your question, the H.J. Heinz Company will send $10 in war stamps plus a set of the 12-volume Britannica Junior Encyclopedia. If we muff the question, you get $57 in war bonds and stamps plus a 24-volume set of the regular Encyclopedia Britannica. All questions remain our property. Information, Please, is presented under the supervision of Dan Golenpaul. And now, our master of ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Ladies and gentlemen, traveling right along in its own spontaneous and unrehearsed manner, Information Please tonight presents its two end men, John Kieran of the New York Sun and Franklin P. Adams, together with two guests, our old friend, the eminent composer and commentator, Deems Taylor, and the famous novelist, whose most recent book is The Valley of Decision, Mrs. Marcia Davenport. Now, we're going to begin with a question from Burkham Ferris of St. Albans, Long Island. I'm going to give you several sets of words. In each of these related sets, which one of the group doesn't belong and why? You have to get two out of three. Here's the first set. Speedwell, Roadrunner, Johnny Jump-Up. One of them doesn't belong, Mr. Kieran.
The Roadrunner does not belong.
Why?
Because the Speedwell and the Johnny Jump-Up are flowers, and the Roadrunner is a very odd bird found plentiful in Arizona.
In Arizona? Only in Arizona?
Well, that's where I've seen it.
And why do they call it Roadrunner? Because
it runs along the roads and over the desert. It's a very funny-looking bird.
Very clear. Very good. That's quite right. Now, how about this set? Lotta Lehmann, Lily Lehmann, Lisa Lehmann. Mr. Davenport.
Lotta Lehmann and Lily Lehmann were singers, but Lisa Lehmann was a composer, and
yeah.
That puts her out of
that
the
puts her out of the, I don't know why they discriminate against an ex-governor, but those are the only three Lehmanns we have. Quite right. Mosquito, Spitfire, Halifax. What one doesn't belong in that set? Mr. Adams.
Halifax.
Why?
Because that is not a an airplane, fighting airplane.
Halifax, isn't it? Yes, it is. Mr. Davenport?
Just the other way around. The Mosquito... And the Halifax is a bomber, and the Mosquito and the Spitfire are fighters.
That's wrong, too, Mr. Taylor.
The Mosquito is a new type of bomber, and the Halifax is also a bomber. The Spitfire is the sharp-nosed British fighting plane.
Yes, that's the one that doesn't belong.
It was on the tip of my tongue.
Well, it took quite a time for Mr. Kieran to set us right. That's one wrong, but that passes us with two out of three and sends us on to this one from Elizabeth Turnell of Urbana, Illinois. Name a character of mythology. Well, I'm going to name three. The first one went through fire for his girl. The second went through water for his. And the third went through the earth for his. Fantastic, all three of them. How about the first? Who went through fire for his girl, Mr. Taylor?
Siegfried.
And for whom?
Brunhilde.
Yes, and was it worth it, Mr. Taylor? Oh, any response?
On the whole, yes.
On the whole, yes, very good. And who went through water for his girl? Went through water. An idea, gentlemen? Does it don't, Mr. Taylor?
I have an idea. Would it be Leander, perhaps?
It would indeed. What was the girl's name?
Hero.
Yes, you're very good at this, Mr. Taylor. And the third is, who went through the earth for his? Mr. Kieran.
Orpheus.
Right. What was
Orpheus.
He went down after Eurydice.
Eurydice.
That's quite right.
He didn't go all the way, though. He only went halfway through the earth.
No, he went down.
But he turned around and came back, didn't he?
Well, what happened, Mr. Taylor, to Orpheus and Eurydice? What was the...
He charmed everybody, including Pluto, to such an extent... That's not Disney's dog. To such an extent that he was allowed to go down and bring his wife back on condition that he did not turn around and look at her.
Yeah.
On the way out.
Often a very easy condition.
Mm-hmm. But he did turn around and look at her, and that was that.
That's quite right, yes. Well, that gives us three out of three. Try this one from Mrs. E.A. Givens of Fresno, California. According to famous songs, what dear departed person is buried in the following places? I'm going to give you the quotes. Let's get two out of three. Dear departed person is buried, quote, in the old churchyard in the valley. Mr. Adams.
Ben Bolt. Sweet Alice.
Sweet Alice, yes. You got the wrong half of the
page. Ben Bolt's her last name.
That's right.
Sweet Alice.
Sweet Alice.
In the corner, obscure and alone, they have fitted a slab of granite so gray.
And Sweet Alice lies under the stone. Yeah.
You have just the voice for that story, my dear. Wonderful. Now, what departed person, equally dear, doubtless, is buried in the valley, the valley, the valley? That is not three persons, but just one. So, Mr. Adams again. Our mortuary expert.
Hallie.
Who?
Sweet Hallie.
Sweet Hallie is right. Very good. In what song would you find it, Mr. Adams?
Listen to the Mockingbird.
And you're going to sing that?
I could.
I think I scared him. Well, there may be some difference
of
opinion.
Thank you, Frank.
Finally, what one is buried in a churchyard near the canyon? In a churchyard near the canyon, Mr. Kieran.
I think that's my darling Clementine.
Yes, that's right. Where the myrtle doth entwine, there grow roses and other posies fertilized by Clementine. Well, that was pretty easy, I guess. Try this. Mr. Taylor, you think it was too easy?
Oh, no.
Frank Craig of Daytona Beach, Florida, sends this one in. It's a musical question, Mrs. Davenport and gentlemen. What is the singer doing as he sings each of these celebrated operatic excerpts? You have to tell us what he's doing in the opera. You see, it should recall the proper scene to you. Let's have the first, and let the singer go through the entire part of the aria. Go ahead. Thank you. That was not Adams, by the way, and just in case anyone was confused. Mr. Davenport?
That's Cavaradossi painting Tosca's portrait.
That's quite right, yes. Cavaradossi is standing. Where's he standing?
In the first act, standing in the ante, in the front part, outside the church. I mean, there's a...
Isn't it a sort of a...
In the cloister, isn't it?
Dais or a raised platform, Mr. Taylor?
Wait a minute. That's a... what do you call that thing at the beginning of a building?
You're not supposed to ask me. I'm supposed to ask you.
Oh.
Maybe
well,
it works better
in the anteroom.
Well, it's on a standing on a dais, a painting, Tosca's picture, as you say, Mr.
I guess
Davenport.
He's in the nave.
Pardon?
No,
I
that would be inside the church, and he's not inside the church.
Isn't
he's
he?
Outside. Don't you know? You see the religious procession that's on its way across.
You better withdraw, Taylor. You're going to get the worst of this, I can tell you. We've had gals like Mrs. Davenport on before. Now try the next one. That's quite right, Mrs. Davenport.
Du mein, als Brautgabe bringt dich Schwert.
I have two hands. Mr. Taylor.
I'll let Mrs. Davenport.
Well, you're right so far, Mrs. Davenport.
I think Mr. Taylor's kidding me. It's Siegfried pulling the sword out of the tree.
Well,
not exactly,
Mr. Taylor.
It's a...
Sigmund.
Oh, sure. I beg your pardon. Sigmund pulling the sword out of the tree.
Well, where's he standing?
He's with one foot on the floor and one foot on the branches of a tree.
Oh, that's
in the
impossible.
Metropolitan, he's standing on something that looks like a picnic table with a tree growing
yes,
up
that's
out
exactly
of it.
Standing on a table. In what opera, Mrs. Davenport, will you find this messy picture? Yes, in Die Walküre, quite right.
And a flickering light from the electrician's department falls upon the hilt of the sword.
You know,
when it works.
You make it sound terrible, I'm glad to hear. And now the third and last.
Oh, Lord, I'm on my way. I'm on my way to heavenly land.
I'll go on, Marcia. I'm disappointed if you don't get
this. Go on,
this.
Beams.
Go
Come
on,
on
yourself.
One, two, three, together. It's Porgy.
Porgy.
Yes, and what's Porgy doing, Mr. Davenport?
Porgy is rolling away on his cart when he sings that. Rolling away from the scene.
That's quite. In what opera would you find?
Porgy, Gershwin's Porgy and Bess.
Porgy and Bess? Yes. How's the cart drawn? What draws the cart?
A goat.
A goat. Do you make two syllables out of that?
Yeah.
Well, generous, aren't you?
Just, you know.
Yes, we got 2.5 out of 3 on that. Try this. Mrs. Carolyn Foster of Mount Vernon sends this one in. Mount Vernon, New York. In each of these plays or poems, all or practically all of the outstanding characters are birds. This is right up your alley, Mr. Kieran. Identify each. Now, here's the first situation. A couple of old men who are dissatisfied with their own city take counsel with the king of the birds. Where would you find that situation? In what play, Mr. Adams?
In a Greek play.
Quite right. In what one?
The Birds.
Yes, by whom?
By...
Aris.
You're not listening to
Euripides.
Taylor, right? No. If you only listen to Taylor instead of being honest.
Aristophanes.
Yes, Aristophanes' famous comedy of the birds. Mm-hmm. Now, here's one in which the hero is enticed into a duel at a guinea hen's 5 o'clock tea. Mr. Kieran.
That is the story of Chanticleer by Rostand.
Yes. And at the tea, what does Chanticleer say? Or what's the... Doesn't he make a kind of lecture, as I recollect it?
Well, he run in a lot of fancy fighting fowl to tear his head off, and he makes fun of them and defies the Pied Blanc, who is the heavyweight champion. And he finally wins, anyhow.
Does he have any... Rustic. That's quite... Does he have any aesthetic doctrine, Chanticleer?
Simplicity.
Simplicity, yes. Old-fashioned values against the aesthetes of the time. Now, in what play or poem are there birds, all of whom are involved in a murder mystery? All of whom are involved in a murder mystery.
Birds involved in a murder mystery.
Found lucubrations going on here. Mr. Adams. Mm.
24 blackbirds baked in a pie.
That's no mystery.
Who were the victims?
Well, there are birds in that, but is it a murder mystery? I don't think so.
Maybe the pie is, but...
Mr. Kieran?
There's one, isn't there, a fairy tale in which the birds cover up the body with leaves and...
Yeah,
that's no mystery, though. They just starved to death.
I'm surprised.
Died of exposure.
You're near to it, more or less. It's a nursery rhyme, Mr. Adams.
Cock Robin.
That's right, Mr. Kieran. Who killed Cock Robin, yes.
Yes, but the birds aren't... But there was a fly involved in it.
Yes, there was a fly involved, too. Well, I don't see why you have to bring that up, Mr. Taylor. Practically all the rest are birds.
Just for the sake of...
We did get 2 out of 3. Now our 57 Varieties reporter... has a message of vital importance to every mother and father of a teenage boy. Ben Grauer.
Through years of association with the farmers of America, we at Heinz have come to have a rather close understanding of their problems. And we realize that the current farm labor shortage not only handicaps the farmer, but seriously threatens America's war effort. That's why we sincerely feel that the Boy Scouts of America, in pledging 100 million hours to farm work this summer, have launched a project worthy of every encouragement. If your boy is not a scout, think what membership now in this great character-building organization would mean to him and his country. While he is helping to relieve the food shortage, he'll be learning about farming, earning money, and at the same time benefiting from such healthful scout activities as camping and hiking. Under the scout farm plan, which varies according to locality, he may either do home gardening, live in an organized work camp, do day hall work, or actually reside on a farm. But no matter what the system, he'll have competent medical care and close supervision. Your son wants a part in winning this war. So encourage him to join the Boy Scouts now. For specific information, simply contact your nearest Boy Scout troop.
Thank you, Mr. Grauer. You've done your good deed for today. And now a question from Edward Van Leer of New York City. Identify the author or composer who used serious music and another for popular music. Although I don't see why the popular music couldn't be serious, too. He used two names. One for doing one kind of music, another for another. Does that come back to you, Mr. Taylor? Or is it far from you?
Oh, you mean...
Why, certainly.
And Bukowski?
Yeah, the idea is to answer the question.
Oh! I thought you were going ahead and name him, you see.
Yeah, we're on the air now, Mr. Taylor, yes. Quite right. Which is his real name, Mr. Taylor?
Dukelsky.
Dukelsky is his real name. Yes. He likes serious music naturally under that name.
And he's in the Navy.
And he's in the Navy, and his name for popular music is Vernon Duke.
Vernon Duke.
Right. Now, how about this one?
Wrote April and
Paris. One was used by this person as an art critic, and another used when he wrote detective stories. Mrs. Davenport.
That's Willard Huntington Wright, who was as an art critic and as a writer of detective stories.
Yes, that's the real name. Name too, doesn't it, Willard Huntington Wright? That's quite right. The creator of Philo Vance. How about this one? He uses one name for books on political economy... this is going to slay you. And he uses the same name for humorous sketches. Who is that? Mr. Taylor.
Stephen Leacock.
Stephen Leacock, the famous Canadian author. Very good.
He is, too.
Very good indeed. You're going on all cylinders, Mr. Taylor, tonight.
Nothing really.
Maybe I can trip you up. John D. Bell of Milwaukee sends this in. Name the play or opera in which a man interferes in a duel with the result that his friend is killed. Mr. Kieran.
Romeo and Juliet.
That is the play and opera. And who kills whom?
Mercutio is slain because Romeo jumps in between him and the furious Tybalt.
That's quite right, yes. Exactly right. Here is one case in which a god interferes in a duel and his son is killed. A guard interferes, Mr. Taylor.
Votan right. interferes in the duel between Hunding and Zygmunt.
That's right. And who gets knocked off?
Zygmunt gets knocked off.
Yes, that's one of the few happy moments
in
the opera.
Scandinavian mythology.
In this case, a wife interferes to save her husband from being murdered. A wife interferes to save her husband from being murdered. That seems to strike you as an exaggerated situation, Mrs. Davenport, gentlemen. Apparently.
Heard of such a thing.
Never heard of such a thing? No. Mrs. Davenport, I'll come back to you.
It's Mr.
Adams.
Give up.
Good. Well, that's all. Which one, Mr. Davenport?
Fidelio,
yes.
Oh.
Now you see how I feel sometimes.
Oh, anyone is liable to make a mistake, and they often do. Yes, Leonora masquerades as Fidelio in prison, isn't that right? And her husband is being held there, and she saves him from being killed. By whom is he supposed to be killed? Forgotten.
Beethoven.
More likely the critics.
A man named Pizarro.
A man named Pizarro. Good. Well, I'm glad to get that information.
He's the man that conquered Peru also, didn't he?
Yes, but it's not the same
not
Pizarro.
Not the same one.
Family,
don't confuse us, Mr. Taylor, with this gratuitous information.
Well,
gives us 2 out of 3. I must stump you people. How about Helen C. Flood's question? This comes from Trenton, New Jersey. What was the nature of the rides that these people took? Mazeppa's ride. What sort of ride was that? And, of course, who was Mazeppa? M-A-Z-E-P-P-A. Mr. Taylor.
Well, I can go no further than to say that she was tied to the back of a horse.
You've got the wrong sex.
Well, I mean,
the horse.
He was tied to the
horses. He was.
Or tied
yeah.
to the back of a mare, you mean?
No. No, Mazeppa does sound as if it would be
Mazeppa
a lady.
Mazeppa was the horse.
An ending.
Do you think Mazeppa was the horse, Adam?
I think Mazeppa was the horse, 8 to 5 and out.
Now, I've got to get myself straight as well as our indulgent audience, and so I will now say, just to confirm what Mr. Taylor was going to say, that in Byron's famous poem of Mazeppa's ride, Mazeppa, who is a man, is tied in a state of undress. Is that right, Mr. Taylor? Naked?
Well, disarray, we call it.
Right. Practically no clothes on. He's tied naked to the back of a wild horse and carries him from the Polish court to the Ukraine somewhere.
Yes.
Do you know why you thought it was a woman?
No. Tell me, Mr. Bones.
All right. For this reason. For this reason that a famous woman actress of the last century, whom you may remember, Mr. Adams, used to play the part of Mazeppa in a state, as you put it delicately, of disarray. And
that's
so many
why.
People got to thinking that Mazeppa was a woman.
Yes.
And you apparently thought the same. But no. Mazeppa was a man
was
played
it Clara
by a woman.
Morris?
Pardon?
Clara Morris?
I don't know, Clara. I don't know who it was. I forget who it was. Some very famous lady. How about Europa's ride? Europa's ride, Mr. Kieran?
She rode on a milk-white bull.
Yes, where?
She was carried out to sea by Jupiter, disguised as the bull, I suppose, across the Aegean or the Ionian Sea.
What? Carried, as a matter of fact, to an island which has recently become very famous, very well known, Crete.
Crete.
Oh, carried to Crete on the back of a white bull. There's no question about the sex of Europa, Mr. Kieran.
Nor of the bull either.
No. Then he come back on that one. How about the famous ride of Skipper Ireson? Skipper Ireson's ride. Mr. Taylor.
Turd and feathered and carried on a rail by the women of Marblehead.
Why, Mr. Adams, did this happen to the poor skipper, do you know? Why was
oh,
he turd and feathered?
I know the women of Marblehead were in that. But
they
why,
certainly
I don't
were, know. Yes.
John knows.
Mr. Kieran?
He refused to rescue some townspeople who were...
Yes, I think he deserted the ship with the men of the town folk aboard. And that's quite right. And you'll find this story, Mr. Kieran, where?
Skipper Ironside's ride.
By
Ironside.
By yes. John G. Whittier.
J.G. Whittier.
By J.G. Whittier. Well, that gives us the complete story.
J. Greenleaf Whittier.
Like pulling teeth. Are you finished with Whittier?
Oh.
Try this one. Martin Roth of New York sends this in. It's about cookery. You cook, Mrs. Davenport?
Yes.
All right. Try this one. With what forms of cookery are these unusual materials associated? The first set of materials Seaweed and canvas. What kind of cookery do you do in association? Mr. Davenport.
A clam bake.
A clam bake. How do you cook clams that way?
Well, you usually sink a barrel in the sand and fill the barrel full of clams.
Yeah.
And other things, lobsters and ears of corn and various things like that. And then on top of that, you put seaweed. And then on top of that, you put a great many hot rocks that you've heated for about a day and a half in a big fire in the sand before. And on top of the whole thing, you put wet canvas, and then you go away and
then you go
it.
Home.
who eats the barrel, Mr. Denton?
Who eats the barrel?
Well, that's exactly right. It's a famous clam bake. I guess you'd find a lot of that sort of stuff around... Maine and
all up
like
down the Atlantic.
Clambeck is also an insufficiently rehearsed radio program.
Yes, but none of your autobiography, Mr.
Don't point.
here's another unusual kind of material used in cookery. A slab of wood. Used in what sort of cookery? A slab of wood, Mr. Adams.
In planked whitefish.
That's odd. I shouldn't be surprised if that were true. Planked whitefish. How do you make planked whitefish at a venture?
You bake it on a plank.
Bake it on a plank. You mean you put the plank in the fire along with the whitefish?
That's right.
You do?
Yes, sir.
Is he right, Mrs. Davenport?
Well, yeah, I think you grill it on a plank, rather than bake it. It has to be done on an open fire of some kind, because that get burnt together.
I think that between the two of you, you've approximately got, in addition to cooking a whitefish...
And steak also.
Steak
you plank
also.
Many things, but notably fish and beefsteak.
Yes, that's quite
not
right.
Nowadays, no beefsteak, kid.
Right.
That's true enough. Now, suppose you... used a hoe blade and hot ashes. You would cook, Mrs. Davenport, what?
Hoe cake.
How's it done?
Well, you make a mess of cornmeal and water and put it on a hoe and stick it in a fire.
Is it any good?
No, it's terrible.
No.
Well, that
and
cancels
again,
about 42
away.
Southern stations, I guess. Got 3 out of 3 on that. Now I notice that our Heinz reporter has a sentimental gleam in his eye that bears investigation. Mr. Grauer.
I'd be the first person in the world to pay tribute to modern architecture, but I'm also old-fashioned enough like that great American institution, the pantry. I can still picture grandmother's pantry with its food-laden shelves, and the mere thought brings back a whole roster of fragrant memories, of great golden-crusted loaves of fresh-baked bread peeking out from under snowy towels, pans of whipped cream and crocks of yellow butter, and on the neatly lined shelves, those familiar Keystone-labeled bottles of Heinz horseradish, pickles, and tomato ketchup. Yes, way back in the horse and buggy days, the 57 varieties were saving time for busy women, adding flavor to their meals just as they do today. For 74 years, the House of Heinz has kept faith with American housewives, brewing their soups to cherished heirloom recipes, putting up their sparkling jellies and crisp green pickles, preparing chili sauce and mustard the careful home way. Perhaps that's why so many Americans of all ages look to Heinz for the quality and flavor that make a meal something to remember.
Thank you, Mr. Grauer. Now try this one. Mrs. A.K. Emery of Corvallis, Oregon, sends this one in. What, according to the poets, is nobly planned? What is nobly planned, Mr. Adams?
A perfect woman.
Yes. Can you go on with the quotation?
Nobly planned to warn, to comfort, and command.
That's exactly
and
right, Mr. Adams.
Seldom executed.
Very well, actually. And what's it from, Mr. Adams?
Wordsworth.
Wordsworth. What's the title of the poem, Mr. Kieran?
She was a phantom of delight.
Yes, she was a phantom of delight. Now, what, according to the poet again, is done quickly? Mr. Kieran.
Murder.
Yes. And in particular, whose murder?
Why, that was Macbeth musing on the contemplated murder of his friend and guest, Duncan.
Yes. You remember the line in which the phrase done quickly is
contained? "'Twere done when, 'twere done then, 'twere well, 'twere done quickly."
Yes, that's it. Very good.
It took longer than the murder.
Mrs. Davenport.
It's the least said.
Yes, least said is soonest mended. I oft have heard defended, little said is soonest mended. Who wrote the lines? Very famous, and I think most of us, including myself, didn't know until now that they were written by...
Sounds a little like Benjamin Franklin.
No, it doesn't... It may sound like Benjamin Franklin, but it was written by a man named George Wither. And now that I say George Wither, it sounds to me very much more as if it were written by George Wither than Benjamin Franklin, Mr. That's 3 out of 3. Mrs. R.D. Stout wouldn't do any harm... if you muffed a couple of questions, Mr. Davenport. And Mrs. R.D. Stout of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, sends this one in. I think we ought to get all three on this. What products are brought from these distant lands to be used by American manufacturers in the following cities? What product is brought from China to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, to be used by an American manufacturer? What from China, Mr. Taylor?
Here goes an encyclopedia. Tungsten.
Oh, that's right. I'm so sorry. Tungsten's quite right. Used in what process?
Manufacture of steel.
Yes, quite right. But I don't know whether we get tungsten from any other place than China. Do you know, Mrs. Davenport?
I don't know. I know it comes in the most important quantities from China, but I think it comes from other Asiatic places, too.
Yes, I have a feeling it does, too. And how about something that's brought from Syria to Richmond? Syria to Richmond. Richmond, the American city. Mrs. Davenport.
Tobacco, for blending tobacco.
Well, but particularly what? Carrying tobacco to Richmond is like carrying coals to Newcastle,
yes, but,
to coin a phrase.
Yes, special kinds of Near Eastern tobaccos that are used in blending with American tobacco.
You mind if I pin you down?
Latakia.
Latakia, yes. I was afraid to say that.
I thought it was
nasty
too commercial.
Smelling tobacco.
No. It's not just something that's grown in Syria. Latakia, it's a special kind of tobacco used, for giving a kind of extra bite, isn't it, in flavor?
It's
tobacco.
It's very mild.
It is mild?
Yes. I think it's used to give bulk, frankly.
Come right out with it and say bulk.
Right.
How do you spell it, Mr. Adams?
Latakia.
Very good. And what product is brought from Sumatra to Pittsburgh? From Sumatra to Pittsburgh.
Dancing girls.
No such luck for Pittsburgh.
They need it.
Ms. Kieran?
Stogies?
Mr. Davenport?
Various kinds of spices for use in H.J. Heinz pickles.
That's very good, Mr. Davenport. Mr. Davenport, you have the makings of a regular guest. We may have time for this from Alice K. Amoson of Chicago. Who hid behind the following things? Who hid behind a hanging? Mr. Kieran.
Polonius, unfortunately for himself.
Good enough. And he was stabbed by our old friend.
Hamlet, Prince of Denmark.
Yes, a case of mistaken
identity. A rat behind the arras.
Right.
Dead for a ducat.
And now, who hid behind a screen?
Who hasn't?
Silver screen?
No, I don't know what it was made of. It was Lady Teazle in The School for Scandal by Sheridan. And who hid behind among trees in a garden? Well, that's a tough one. It was Adam and Eve who hid from God because they had eaten of the tree of knowledge and therefore knew shame.
Never heard of them.
Well,
never
and that will send $57 in war bonds and stamps to Miss Amoson and a set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Thank you, Mr. Davenport and Mr. Taylor, for adding to the fund this evening. Tonight, the H.J. Heinz Company has paid out $57 in war bonds and stamps and one set of the Britannica. Next week, the good old trio of Adams, Kieran, and Levant will bat them out along with our guest, the famous British author Hilary St. George Saunders, author of the bestseller about the Commandos, Combined Operations. Remember, send your questions and the correct answers to Information, Please, at 570 Lexington Avenue, New York City. And now, Ben Grauer.
H.J. Heinz Company wishes you good night and good health. Be with us again next Monday at the same time to help stump the experts. And this week, if your son isn't now a Boy Scout, encourage him to join this organization, whose members are doing so much to win the war as they build the foundation of a finer America in the years to come.
This program came to you from New York. This is the National Broadcasting Company.